You stupid bitch. Yeah, you're a stupid bitch. You stupid bitch.
Welcome to this week's episode of Stupid Bitches Say What, the Aussie podcast about everything and nothing, but always with wine, and your hosts, Skylee Collett and Sean Hipkins.
This week, it's true crime, and we're jumping to the largest country in the Western Hemisphere, plus the land of the red maple leaf and our Commonwealth brothers and sisters. Oh, Canada. Listen in while I cover the case of Paul Bernardo and Carla Hollmacher, aka the Kent and Barbie Killers, the husband and wife team who abducted, raped, and murdered a number of young girls in the 90s, while Sean covers the case of Cindy James, the Canadian nurse who claims to have been stalked and harassed and eventually is found dead. But what caused her death? Was it suicide, an accident, or a brutal murder?
Ooh.
Buckle up, bitches. We're about to get crazy. What you drinking, Sean Beano Hipkins?
Well, thank you for asking, Sky. I'm drinking a new one this week. This one, I think, is a good Pear Days. Mm. And it's, and I did this because I thought you might appreciate it. It's called the White Stripes.
Oh, I do like that. What a clever little white bottle. I mean, a clever little bottle. I told you I was going to struggle.
Why everything got to be white?
I'm going to struggle to be witty tonight and string sentences together.
And you'll also be pleased to know it's a Sangiovese.
Sangiovese?
2021.
I love a Sangiovese.
And it's a South Victorian. It is delish. During our, we've had a little trouble setting up tonight, dear listeners. Mm. We might even get in How's Your Week Been, an update from Sky's night tonight. So I've already poured and I've had a sip, but for the purpose of the podcast, there's another sip and I'm really liking that. And what, pray tell, are you drinking, you stupid fucking bitch?
Well, I'm not drinking a Sangiovese, Sandra. They say.
The E is a.
So I'm actually having wine envy right now because I'm just thinking I'd actually rather a drop of Sangiovese.
It's fucking delicious. I can recommend this.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm just drinking a little cheeky white as per usual, but now it's starting, well, it's not really cold.
We had a bit of
a breeze this morning. We're like, oh my God, it's been autumn.
It's been a fucking long summer, people.
Now I'm talking about turning onto the reds already because I get a hint of a breeze this morning. I looked at this in the pub and I thought to myself, I don't think I've drunk that before. But now I'm looking at it as close up and I'm like, I've definitely drunk this before. So I'm drinking a Pepperjack Sauvignon Blanc. Surprise. Oh. It's from Tasmania. It's a 2022.
Oh, nice.
And that's about all I have to say on that.
Tasmanian wines are always a good choice.
Oh, I thought there was something in it then, but it's just a reflection of the light, I think.
It's just your face. Mm. Her face is in it right now, people.
Oh, it's nice.
Is it?
It's a little tart, which is the way I like it, but very light.
Well, we can relate to a little tart, can't we?
We can. We can indeed. It's delicious. I'm enjoying it. Very good. How's your week been, stupid bitch?
Look, it has been a struggle street week.
An absolute horror.
Jesus Christ. So my birthday was on the 24th of March. I had a bit of a shindig on the 25th at the Boundary Hotel that turned into complete chaos. So we thought we'd have a 1 o'clock start, be sure everyone would be in bed by 10 o'clock. I crept away at 1 o'clock after we had about 12 people in our one bedroom apartment, raging on after the pub, listening to Eurovision YouTubes.
Fighting. We were delightful, weren't we? We were a delightful bunch.
Very subdued. I think the neighbours were worried there was no noise.
There no noise? We were serenading each other at the top of our lungs and I lost my voice from screaming Eurovision songs at you.
I was being facetious. But, it was a great night. it took me till Wednesday before I finally felt normal again. Thank God I had the Monday off work. Tuesday was struggle, but it was a work from home day, so that was okay too. But yeah, fuck me.
Yeah, she told me in our impromptu fire drill meetup.
Mm. That's right. We had the fire drill meetup too. We'll have to cover that. But yeah, it was a great party. Lots of regrets afterwards, but lots of fun at the time. But yeah, speaking of the Eurovision catch up, so we came back to my apartment, dear listeners, and the deal was we're only going to have a couple of people and we were going to do a Eurovision viewing party. Get more familiar with the songs. Get ready for our Eurovision special, which isn't too far away.
Intimate group of friends.
That turned into a household full. The deal was that they had to listen to the Eurovision song. So it was no ifs and or buts, but then there were a couple of buts.
Oh, wasn't there what?
and a couple of fights. But I have to say, and I thought about this afterwards, they were fighting about what we were going to play on Eurovision. Skye, I think that was probably the first time in history that you and I have had a drunken night where we completely agreed on what was going to happen on YouTube. There was even a time, and it's appropriate because the next episode is our special episode, which I won't mention. Well, it's Glee. But fucking, you said at one stage, all right, now we're doing a Glee theme, only Glee. And I was like, yes, yes. And we're looking at each other with love and hope in our eyes about what we were going to put on. And I'm like, what one? What's a good one? And you're like, I don't know. And I was like, I don't know either. And we couldn't think of any fucking Glee songs, but we so badly wanted to be able to do it. And then there was another theme we went down as well. You're like, okay, only Kylie or Madonna or something. I can't remember, but fuck me.
I can't even remember.
It was a lot of fun, but we agreed. We didn't fight over music.
We did. I remember us sitting there like two little peas in a pod on the couch, just going, serenading each other and then going, next. Okay, let's put this on. Yes, yeah. Let's totally put this on.
I agree with you. And then fucking up that
Eurovision. No one else agreed with us, though.
I know, but fuck them. Mama. What was that? Oh, Mama, see ya.
See. And I kept saying, do you remember, I kept saying, it's Bino's birthday. He gets to pick whatever song he wants.
Yes, I did get to pull rank. That was really nice. Thank you for that and your support. Yeah. So how about you, dear Skye? How was your week? How was your recovery session?
Oh, look, it was pretty tough, considering how sick I became, which, you know me, I never spew. So I have some theories on that I'll share with you later. But yes, I was.
Do you think it could have to do with the fact that we were drinking 12-year-old $100 whiskeys by the end of the night on top of all the other shit we were drinking?
I think it might. And also, Vinny kept putting Coke in mine and I kept yelling at him because he kept like, he'd make me one. And he was the one who brought out the whiskey.
Oh, 100%, too,
I have, you know, 100%. Like because I wasn't even drinking that much because I opened a bottle of wine. I'm certain I didn't finish it. I was drinking those vodka squashes and I think I had one and then I gave the rest to Nat. So I was doing okay until the whiskey came out.
Yeah.
And then he was like, have this whiskey. And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll have whiskey. You know me, I love whiskey. And he brings it over and he put Coke in it. And I said, what the hell is this?
I drink it straight.
I don't drink my whiskey with Coke. And he was like, oh, it'll be okay. And then I remember Ashton saying, oh, yeah, it'll be fine. It's just a little bit of Coke. And he's like, I didn't ever put that much in, just a smidge. And I was like, I can't drink with Coke. I hate Coke. I can't drink it. So then I think he sculled mine and poured me a fresh one. And there was many, many, many whiskeys after that.
Yes, there was. His bottle, and he said the next day, he's like, fuck. Because it's like it's red breast and it's what his family in Ireland drink. And he was very proud of it. And then the next day he picked up, he's like, fuck's sake, why did I do this? We wouldn't have even appreciated it. I'm just glad the tequila shots didn't come out.
Oh, God.
Imagine.
We have no self-control at all. What is wrong with us?
I think as we got older and wiser, we would, but no.
Oh, that it was terrible. And because I was sick and in the cab, and Tyler was like trying to stop me from falling asleep the whole time because he said, he goes, once you pass out and you're drunk, you cannot be woken. Like nothing will wake you. And he's like, and if you fell asleep in the couch, I would have to be literally dragging you out.
And or from the Uber.
And then we got out the front and I got out of the Uber and he had my shoes and everything. And he said, I walked straight past the house. Started walking up the street. And he's like, babe, where are you going? And I went, what? And he's like, in there. And I went, okay.
And it's not like you to voluntarily walk somewhere.
No, I know. And then, but I do remember I was coherent enough to remember checking in on Link and opening the door and going, hey, Linky. And he was passed out because it was fucking 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And so he had mates over too, and we still outlasted him.
This is how we do.
So I remember that. I remember opening the door and seeing him passed out and then getting up to bed. But I do believe that Tyler assisted me in getting
navigating your way
in terms of, you know, taking my clothes and my bra off and everything.
He's like, baby. Like,
taking everything off and putting. And I remember he did say to me, take your earrings off with those hoops. You're going to rip your ears open. You sleep in those hoops.
Oh, bless him. He knows about the hoop.
He takes very good care of me. But sometimes I say to him, I say, you know, I used to get home on my own before I was married, before we met, you know, because he's always like, oh, I worry about you sometimes. And I'm like, oh, plus.
I'm fine. I've done this a million times.
I just would have slept on the boy's carpet if you hadn't took me home.
Oh, hilarious. And then what happened tonight? Do you want to get into that on this?
Oh, look, there's not much to tell except that Tyler has been running around all day doing the footy club stuff because I, you remember, they changed the date a whole bunch of times and yeah. I kept changing my date to make sure I was there for opening night. And then they moved it again at the last minute to this weekend. And I was like, and I'd already changed things around when I knew a couple of times and I was like, I can't change it again. And it was just going to set us back. So I told them that. So we've got a bunch of volunteers in there, but Tyler... Well, he hasn't been working full shifts this week anyway, so he went out to sort it all out for me and do all the deliveries. So he's been running around all day because as soon as he got out to the clubhouse, some people were like, hey, you're here. Can you do this job for us? Can you do this for us? Can you do that for us? He's like, yeah, okay. So I dropped him at his car at like – I got into work at 7 this morning, so I dropped him at his car at like 20 to 7. He pretty much went to the shops at Redland Bay, went out to the clubhouse and didn't get back at the house until midday.
Oh, God.
Because he was out there doing stuff. And he was literally just supposed to go and get some alcohol and some stock for tonight and then just leave it at the clubhouse. So he was running around and he came home and did a few. We were supposed to have a shift today and he helps people with their resumes. So that's right. What he's been taking my computer for. And I actually had this inkling. I pulled into the driveway. I've been running around. I perfectly timed the evening. I was at work until about 10 past six.
Oh,
had dinner at work because I just had my leftover lunch. So I had that and I was like, well, I've eaten now before I start drinking. And then Jesus. Pulled into the bottle shop for my wines and everything, pulled into the driveway at 20 to 7. And I thought, perfect amount of time to get upstairs. Pour a glass of wine, set up my new microphone, yeah. Get the computer ready. And then as I turned the car off, I thought to myself, because I knew he'd been using my laptop for this resume stuff he's been doing. And I thought to myself, oh my God, he had that. So he had a shift today, but it got canceled, but he still got paid for it because the kid couldn't do something or whatever. And I thought to myself, I bet he's fucking taking my laptop to help this kid with his resume. And then I always knew he was going straight to football anyway from the shift. So it would have been in his car. And I was like, no, he would have known. And so I get upstairs and it's not there. And I ring him and I said, please tell me you don't have my laptop. And he was like, oh my God, I totally do. He's like, all right, I'm cutting. And we planned to start at 7. This was about 6:45 by that point. And his game kicked off at 7:30 at Redland Bay.
Oh, God.
So they were all just starting to warm up and everything, even though he's been there all afternoon.
Yeah.
They were all starting to warm up and he's like, I'm in the car. I'm running to the car now.
Oh, bless
him. And I was like, you fucking better run.
Bitch.
So then I drove to Cleveland 7-Eleven.
Yeah, and he met you there.
And he met me there. And then, it was okay. I was 15 minutes late in the end.
Yeah. And he was like, I could just imagine the whole insides just dropping when you're not seeing it, just going, oh, for fuck's sake.
And I was just like, I perfectly timed everything to get home.
Yes. So are we going to get into it?
Let's get into it.
Because, dear listeners, we do have a double tonight for you.
We do. We've only got...
I'm feeling a bit pissy already.
Three more episodes after this, and then our Eurovision special. It's the end of season 5. I can't believe it.
And what else happened this week, dear Beano?
The evacuation.
We'll talk about that more in the next episode. Oh,
yes, of course. Yes.
What else happened?
We hit 5,000 listens.
We did. Yeah. Well, 5,000 downloads, really.
It's downloads.
Just, people download the podcast to listen to
this
it.
This is so true. I've got our post ready to go tomorrow, but I've called it 5,000 listens. Should call it
perfect
plays or something. I don't know. Downloads. But yes, that was a very big achievement. We haven't even finished season 5. Mm. We're averaging over 1,000 plays a season.
I actually hadn't really thought about it like that. That's pretty cool, isn't it? 1,000 plays a season.
Yeah, for a couple of, kids just making their way through life.
Yeah, just, trying to do some things during COVID.
Yes. Actually, Rachel, our friend... Rachel and her husband, Adrian. So Rachel was
telling me, Raquel, please.
She was telling us.
Hi, Raquel. We love you.
Hey, Raquel. She was telling me that she'd not forgotten about the podcast, but hadn't seen the episodes coming up. And she started listening again when she was going to Adelaide this week. And she listened to the paranormal and the horror movies of yesteryear episode. And she said she was wetting herself on the plane and getting all these weird looks from the person sat next to her. She said, it's so good. I learned so much about you too. So hi, Rach.
I love that.
Yeah, me too. That was nice. But yes, let's get into it because we do have a double.
Oh, shit. I need to. I'm going first, am I?
You're
going to
lead us off with this one. So I did the last true crime first. It's nice to mix it up, I think.
All right. I just have to put you in my little peripheral so I can read my notes, please. Okay. Are you ready?
I am.
Paul Kenneth Bernardo, born August 27, 1964, is a Canadian serial rapist and serial killer dubbed the Scarborough Rapist, the Schoolgirl Killer, and together with his former wife, Carla Holmaker, one of the Ken and Barbie killers. He is known for initially committing a series of rapes in Scarborough, Ontario, a suburb of Toronto, between 1987 and 1990, before committing 3 murders with Holmaker. Among these victims was Carla's younger sister, Tammy Holmaker.
It is absolutely horrendous.
Oh, it gets worse.
So he did rapes and then he raped and killed with the wife. Right.
After his capture and conviction, Bernardo was sentenced to life imprisonment and later declared a dangerous offender, thus making it unlikely that he will ever be released from prison. Following his conviction, Bernardo confessed to 10 more rapes committed a year before the spree ascribed to Scarborough rapist. Carla Holmaker was given a lighter sentence in exchange for testifying against Bernardo as part of a controversial plea bargain.
Yeah.
She was released from prison in 2005.
Oh, wow.
Whilst the crimes committed by Paul Bernardo alone are both heinous and of a significant nature and volume, for the purpose of tonight's true crime segment, I am only going to focus on what he and his wife were capable of and where they are today.
Very good.
The Ken and Barbie killers. Many experts believe that Carla Holmaker always had sociopathic tendencies. Those experts assert that it wasn't until her late teens that Holmaker's dangerous tendencies revealed themselves. In her early life, she was, for all intents and purposes, a normal kid.
Right.
Born May 4th, 1970. Wasn't that the year you were born?
No, darling heart. It was the year my older brother was born, though. My oldest brother.
Oh, sorry, my mistake. She grew up in Ontario, Canada, in a well-adjusted family of 5 as the oldest of 3 daughters. Indeed, following her high school graduation, she began working at a local veterinary clinic. It's concerning, isn't it? But then on a fateful midsummer trip for work to a veterinary convention in Toronto in 1987, 17-year-old Hallmarker met 23-year-old Paul Bernardo.
That's a problem with a lot of these husband and wife killers, isn't it? By fate, when they meet, you know, so maybe, I mean, the guy obviously was a fucking scumbag already, but if she never met him, would she have gone down that?
How do they get to that conversation where, like, hey, you know,
want to stab a bitch?
Yeah, are you into that? Like, because I am. Let's do it together.
Yeah, I know.
The two connected instantly and became inseparable. Carla Hallmarker and Paul Bernardo also developed a shared taste for sadism, with Bernardo as the master and Hallmarker as the slave.
Yeah.
Allegedly, plus, some believe that Hallmarker had been coerced by Bernardo to commit the heinous crimes that later landed her in prison. But still, others believe that Hallmarker entered into the relationship willingly and was every bit a sadistic criminal mastermind as he was. What can't be denied is that Carla Hallmarker willingly offered up her own sister to Bernardo. Oh. Bernardo had apparently been upset by the fact that Hallmarker, Carla, had not been a virgin when they met. In order to make up for this, he allegedly ordered that she bring him a girl who was a virgin, and she decided upon her own sister, Tammy. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Hit me with it.
By 1990, Bernardo had lost his job as an accountant and was smuggling cigarettes across the nearby Canada-United States border.
Canada.
Canada. I had dinner, by the way, too. I'm only on like fucking this much wine.
And what a fucking, like, it was the 90s and he was still smuggling cigarettes then. Jesus Christ.
It would have been to avoid taxes, please.
I know, but still, you know, like you look at the price now, you could say, oh, yeah, I see where you're smuggling cigarettes. Yeah. $50 a pack. They were $2 a pop.
He spent long periods of time with Hallmarker's family, who liked him. And although he was engaged to Carla, he had become obsessed with her younger sister, Tammy. Peering into her window and entering her room to masturbate while she slept.
Oh, God. How old was Tammy, do we know?
She was 15.
Oh, God.
Yeah, hang on. Let me just go back. Yeah. Yeah, she was 15. She was a baby.
So she was probably 14 at the time he was doing this shit as well. Yeah. Scumbag.
Carla helped Bernardo by breaking the window in her sister's room, allowing him access. According to Bernardo's testimony at trial, Carla laced spaghetti sauce with crushed Valium she had stolen from her employer at the animal clinic. She served it to her sister, who soon lost consciousness. Bernardo then raped Tammy while Carla watched. After 1 minute, Tammy regained consciousness.
How the fuck did you watch that? Oh, God.
That was the first time. 6 months before their 1991 wedding, Carla stole the anesthetic called halothane from the clinic that she worked at. And on December 23, 1990, Carla and Bernardo administered sleeping pills to 15-year-old Tammy in a rum and eggnog cocktail. When Tammy lost consciousness, Carla and Bernardo undressed her, and Carla applied a halothane-soaked cloth to her sister's nose and mouth. Carla wanted to give Tammy's virginity to Bernardo for Christmas. According to her, Bernardo was disappointed that he was not Carla's first sex partner. With Tammy's parents sleeping upstairs, the couple videotaped themselves raping Tammy in the basement.
Oh, my God. And that's another thing, like when you say about, you know, how do you have those conversations that you want to start killing people as a couple? When does it come, like, okay, for Christmas?
Yeah.
I'm going to let you rape my sister.
Oh, you wait. You wait. And this was just after a Christmas party that the family had. They'd all attended. Like, the parents had family over and friends over, and there was a full Christmas party. That's why it was eggnog that they laced. So the parents had gone to bed after the party, and this is what happens.
Jesus. And did she not say anything, the little girl?
Well, she was, you'll just wait.
Okay.
So Tammy began to vomit. So remember, so they've drugged her with pills.
And put the shit over her face.
Yeah. They've raped her and then they put the tranquilizer thing over her face. So she began to vomit. They tried to revive her and called 911 after hiding evidence, dressing Tammy and moving her into her bedroom. A few hours later, Tammy was pronounced dead at St. Catherine's General Hospital without regaining consciousness.
Poor little darling.
I know. Despite being observed vacuuming and washing laundry in the middle of the night and despite a chemical burn on Tammy's face, the coroner and Carla's family accepted the couple's version of events. The official cause of Tammy's death was ruled accidental, the result of choking on vomit after consumption of alcohol. After Tammy's death, Bernardo and Carla videotaped themselves engaging in sexual intercourse with Carla wearing Tammy's clothing and pretending to be her.
Oh, my God. That's messed up.
They moved out of the Holmucker house to a rented bungalow to allow Carla's parents to grieve. So there's evidence.
Yeah.
Like there's videotape evidence of some of this stuff too.
Yeah.
This isn't just like alleged what
someone
happened.
Ratting on someone or making a story this
or making assumptions and making stuff up. Yeah. Despite the family tragedy, if you can believe this, the couple got married 6 months later in a reportedly lavish ceremony. There's also a very Scott and Charlene wedding photo for the two of them that you need to see. So before the wedding, however, Leslie Maffey crossed paths with Paul Bernardo. Early in the morning of June 15th, 1991, while detouring through Burlington to steal license plates, Bernardo came across 14-year-old Leslie Maffey. Maffey had been locked out of her house for a missed curfew after attending a friend's wake.
Oh, God, I bet her parents feel like shit now.
He left his car and approached her, saying that he wanted to break into a neighbor's house. Unfazed, she asked if he had any cigarettes. He led her back to his car. He blindfolded her, forced her in, drove her to the bungalow where he lived with Carla, and informed Holmucker that they had a victim. Bernardo and Holmucker videotaped themselves torturing and sexually abusing Mahaffey while they listened to pop music. At one point, he said, "You're doing a good job, Leslie, a damn good job," adding, "The next 2 hours are going to determine what I do to you. Right now, you're scoring perfect."
Mentally fucking torturous.
On another segment of tape played at Bernardo's trial, the assault escalated. She cried out in pain and begged him to stop. In the description of the scene, he was sodomizing her while her hands were bound with twine. McAfee later told Bernardo that her blindfold seemed to be slipping, which signaled the possibility that she could identify her attackers if she lived. The following day, Bernardo claimed Holmucker fed her a lethal dose of Halcyon. Holmucker claimed that Bernardo strangled her. They put Mahaffey's body in the basement the day before Holmucker's family had dinner at the house.
Jesus Christ. And to imagine having to be on that jury and watching these videos or the family.
Well, they actually only played the audio, but they described, the prosecution described the imagery.
What was actually going on. Even still, that would be fucking just...
It would be so brutal. But they decided that it was too much to put them through the visual.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Scenes of it. So this young woman was dead in their basement at their house, and they had their family, her family, who's they've just lost their daughter, and they had them over for dinner. Well, they've got another murdered girl downstairs.
And you could imagine that they would probably be having little, not side jokes as such, but knowing that there's someone there, they'll probably getting their kicks off it.
Well, apparently she's innocent and was coerced. Anyways.
Sky does not believe so. I can tell from her tone.
Following the dinner party, Bernardo and Holmucker decided to dismember Mahaffey's body and encase each part of her remains in cement. Bernardo brought a dozen bags of cement at a hardware store the following day. He kept the receipts, which were damaging at his trial.
Oh, good.
After he cut apart the body using his grandfather's circular saw, the couple made a number of trips to dump the cement blocks in the nearby lake about 18 kilometers from their home. One of the blocks weighed 90 kilos, 200 pounds, but I converted it to 90 kilos.
Oh, very good.
And was forward beyond thinking. Their ability to sink. It lay near the shore where it was found on June 29th, 1991, coincidentally on Bernardo and Holmucker's wedding day.
Oh, how special. On my first wedding anniversary, I want cement.
That's not amusing, plus. And her orthodontic appliance was instrumental in identifying her. So because they couldn't...
She had braces, yeah.
...get that down, they couldn't weigh it down. They couldn't properly get it into the water to get it to weigh down.
Yeah.
That's ultimately how they identified who she was on the day that they got married.
Oh, the poor girl.
So several days before Holmucker's release from prison in July 2005, Bernardo was interviewed by police and his lawyer, Tony Bryant. According to Bryant, Bernardo stated that he had always intended to free the girls he and Holmucker had kidnapped. However, when Mahaffey's blindfold fell off, Holmucker was concerned that she would identify them and report the couple to the police. He claims that she planned to murder her by injecting an air bubble into her bloodstream, triggering an air embolism.
Wow. So they've just completely turned on each other, this couple of star-crossed lovers.
Completely. So almost a year later, during the after-school hours of April 16th, 1992, Bernardo and Holmucker drove through St. Catharines, which was the area that they lived in, to look for potential victims. Although students were still home, the streets were generally empty. As they passed the secondary college, they spotted 15-year-old Kristen French walking home. After they pulled into the lot of a nearby church, Holmucker got out of the car carrying a map, pretending to need assistance. When French looked at the map, Bernardo attacked her from behind, forcing her into the front of the seat of the car at knife point. From the back seat, Holmucker subdued French by pulling her hair. After French failed to arrive home, her parents became convinced that she met with foul play and notified police. Within 24 hours, the police service assembled a team, searched the after-school route, and found several witnesses who had seen the abduction from different locations.
And none of them decided to call the police as well.
Her shoes were recovered from the parking lot, and that obviously pointed to the seriousness of the abduction. There is something that I left out of this because it is a long story, but there was a complete inquiry, like after they were sentenced, into the police and whether or not they did all the right things throughout the process because of how much he got away with and what should they have done differently. Because how could one man get away with all these crimes?
Because he did all those rapes as well.
What he did and still, you know, and obviously what happened with Tammy at the house. Like she had a burn mark on her face, a chemical burn mark on her face.
Yeah.
And she was a healthy 15-year-old who had a glass of eggnog. And basically they were like, there should have been more they could have done.
Yeah.
So over the Easter weekend, Bernardo and Holmucker videotaped themselves torturing, raping and sodomizing French, the young girl, Kristen French.
That takes it to a whole other level. Like, I know that murder is bad and what they were doing was obviously extremely terrible, but to then videotape it so you can watch it again over and over just adds another layer of sadistic fucking shit to it, doesn't it?
This girl as well, Holmucker, she came from a loving family. Like she was having dinners with them. You know, she was like, she maintained a healthy relationship with them through this whole period. So I'm sorry.
Knowing she killed her sister.
I don't buy it. I don't buy that she was battered or, you know, she was like, oh, I was scared for my life. No way. You don't kill your little sister. No way in the world.
Yeah.
And then keep it to yourself. I'm sorry. I don't buy any of it, but we'll get to that. So they forced her to drink large amounts of alcohol and submit to Bernardo. At his trial, the prosecutor said that Bernardo always intended to kill French because she was never blindfolded and could identify her captors. The following day, Bernardo and Holmucker murdered French before going to Holmucker's parents for Easter dinner.
They have a fucking bit of a system, don't they?
Yeah.
It's like they're like catching up with the parents after they've murdered someone.
Yeah, it's almost like to give them an alibi too. Like it's like, oh, we're going to go there. So yeah. It looks like nothing's wrong and no one would ever suspect what we've done. So Holmaker testified at her trial that Bernardo strangled French for 7 minutes while she watched. Bernardo claimed that Holmaker beat French with a rubber mallet because she tried to escape. And French was strangled with a noose around her neck, which was secured to a chest. And so
of drawers.
And Holmaker was responsible for that because she needed the weight of it to do it because she was a small woman.
Yeah.
And then after that, she went to fix her hair before the Easter dinner. French.
That sounds a bit more specific too, doesn't it?
It does. I think, yeah. So French's nude body was found on April 30th, 1992 in a ditch about 45 minutes from where she had been taken and a short distance from the cemetery where Leslie Mahaffey is buried. She had been washed and her hair was cut off. Although it was thought that the hair was removed as a trophy, a Holmaker testified that it was cut to impede identification.
Right.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
That they hadn't done that before.
But then they decided to do it
in this case.
Yeah. Well, had they found the body of the other one before by this time? Yeah, and they had the orthopedic, so they're trying to now up their game, I guess.
Yeah, totally. But that sounds so calculated that if you were trying to subdue your partner at the same time from all this stuff, like you, I feel like it was very carefully planned.
Yeah, yeah.
So Holmaker and Bernardo were questioned by police several times in connection with the Scarborough rapist investigation. Tammy Holmaker's death and Bernardo's stalking of other women before French's abduction. So there was things, and this is where why I think they started the inquiry, because there was things that sort of didn't like make him look like a suspect, but things that were coincidental in a way that it was like, oh, he's in the same place as this happened or something like that. So nothing that was like, there was absolutely no evidence to say he was involved in any of this stuff, but like there was
the pieces were starting to fit
bits
together
and pieces all over. So on May 12th, 1992, Bernardo was briefly interviewed by officers who decided that he was an unlikely suspect, despite his admission that he had previously been questioned in connection to the Scarborough rapist. So they've questioned him for all these rapes and then this murder, but they were like, yeah, nah, he's good.
There's no connection here.
3 days later, the Green Ribbon Task Force was created to investigate the murders of Mahaffey and French. Bernardo and Holmaker.
And I was just saying, when you said, like, they've questioned him about these murders, the rapes, but they didn't even think about the fact that the Holmaker's daughter had also died, that he's got strong connections with, and they didn't piece that together either.
So the Green Ribbon Task Force. Force was created to investigate the two murders, not Tammy, because she was considered not murdered. She died of natural. Well, she died.
Of course, Well, that's what they said. Yeah,
choking. Accidental. So at the same time, Bernardo and Holmaker applied to have their names legally changed to Teal, which Bernardo had taken from the serial killer in the 1988 film Criminal Law.
Oh, nothing sus here.
So just randomly. Being investigated, two women have been murdered. He's been questioned on two separate cases. Oh, we're just going to change our names.
To another murderer.
Well, I've never heard of the film, so, No. But I guess it was an 88 film, so this is 92. So, again, back then.
It was pretty current.
At the end of May, John Moultal, an acquaintance of acquaintance of Bernardo, reported him to police as a possible suspect in the murders. He got suspicious, I think.
He had a hunch.
In December 1992, the Center of Forensic Sciences finally began testing DNA samples provided by Bernardo 2 years earlier. So remember, he was questioned in the Scarborough rapes. And they obviously swabbed him or something, but, forensic science, how it's evolved.
And back then, it was very
there was no DNA. When did DNA testing?
Oh, I think DNA sort of came around in the 80s, but I don't think it was ever as fucking, it was never as good as it is now, and they wouldn't have had the databases and all that shit.
Yeah.
So on December 27th of the same year, 1992, Bernardo severely beat Holmacher with a flashlight, leaving multiple bruises. Surprise!
Yeah.
That was a long time coming, right?
Yeah.
Claiming that she had been in a car accident, she returned to work on the 4th of January, 1993. Her co-workers were skeptical and they called her parents. And although the parents went and rescued her the following day by removing her from the house, she went back to frantically search for something. So then Holmacher's parents took her to the general hospital. She gave a statement to the police that she was a battered spouse and filed charges against Bernardo. He was arrested and later released on his admittance that he had harmed his wife.
Pig.
Mm. So 26 months after Bernardo submitted a DNA sample back in the Scarborough investigation, Toronto police were informed that it matched that of the Scarborough rapist and immediately placed him under 24-hour surveillance. Metro Toronto Sexual Assault Squad investigators interviewed Holmacher on February 9th, 1993, so they were estranged by that point.
Yeah.
Despite hearing their suspicions that they divulged to her about Bernardo, she focused on his abuse of her.
Of course, because it's all about me.
Later that night, Holmacher told her aunt and uncle that Bernardo was the Scarborough rapist, that she and Bernardo were involved in the rape and murder of Mahaffey and French, and that the rapes were recorded on videotape. Nothing about her sister, mind you.
Mm. Well, you don't want to admit that to fucking family, do you?
The authorities subsequently reopened its investigation of Tammy Holmacher's death, though.
Good.
2 days later, Holmacher met with a Niagara Falls lawyer, George Walker, who sought legal immunity from the prosecutor in exchange for her cooperation. She was also placed under 24-hour surveillance. The couple's name change was approved on the February 13th, 1993.
So that was still going on in the background.
Yep. The next day, Walker met with the criminal law office director, Murray Siegel. After Walker told Siegel about the videotapes, Siegel advised him that due to Holmacher's involvement in the crimes, full immunity was not a possibility.
Yes. You got to pay for some of it, bitch.
Yes. So they knew that there was videotapes that explicitly showed her to some degree. They didn't know what degree. So they were offering her immunity, but not the full scale.
Yeah.
On February 17th, detectives arrested Bernardo on several charges and obtained a search warrant. Because his link to the murders was weak, they hadn't found the tapes yet. She'd just said there was tapes. The warrant was limited. No evidence, which was not expected and documented in the warrant, could be removed from his property. So the search of the house, including updated warrants, lasted 71 days.
Jesus.
And the only tape found by police had a brief segment of Holmacher performing oral sex on a Jane Doe. During a call from jail, Bernardo told his lawyer, Ken Murray, that the rape videos were hidden in a ceiling light fixture in the upstairs bathroom. Murray, the lawyer, found the tapes and hid them from investigators.
Oh, what a scumbag.
Oh, I know. It gets worse. After Murray resigned as Bernardo's lawyer, his new attorney, John Rosen, turned the tapes over to the police.
What a fucking asshole. Like, how could he actually live with himself knowing that this had happened?
He wanted to win. Just,
yeah, I know. But that, case. What a fucking, like, that type of behavior is sort of, to some extent, as bad as what Paul Bernardo was doing. Like, he's allowing him to fucking.
Anyway, so then the new lawyer turned them over to the police. On May 5th, Walker was informed, so this is her lawyer, that the government was offering her a plea bargain of 12 years imprisonment, which she had 1 week to accept. If she declined, the government would charge her with 2 counts of first-degree murder, 1 count of second-degree murder, and other crimes that he was associated with. Walker, the lawyer, accepted the offer, and Holmacher later agreed to it. On May 14th, my birthday, please.
And also Eurovision's airtime in Australia this year.
Holmaker's plea bargain was finalised and she began giving statements to police investigators. So she said a little bit, enough for them to find some information, but she hadn't told them what she knew.
Yeah.
She told police that Bernardo boasted that he had raped as many as 30 women, twice as many as the police suspected.
God.
Citing the need to protect Bernardo's right to a fair trial, a publication ban was imposed on Holmaker's preliminary inquiry. The Crown had applied for the ban through her lawyers and Holmaker supported the ban. Bernardo's lawyers argued that he would be prejudiced by this and since Holmaker had been portrayed as his victim. So,
of course, yeah. They weren't allowed that's the angle she's taking now too, isn't it?
They weren't allowed to publicise the trial in any way. So four media outlets and one author opposed the ban. Some lawyers argued that rumours could damage the future trial process more than the publication of evidence, blah, 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 blah. In February 1994, Holmaker divorced Bernardo. So public access to the internet effectively nulled the court's orders, as did proximity to the US-Canada border. So American journalists, not subject to the publication ban, published details of Holmaker's testimony, which were distributed by electronic ban breakers, newspapers in Buffalo, Detroit, Washington, D.C., New York City, and the United Kingdom, as well as radio and television stations. I think this is crazy. This is just a sign of the times.
Yeah.
So Canada was like, hey, you can't like publish anything. And then
we're a good country.
The rest of us like, fuck this shit. So Canadians brought copies of the Buffalo News across the border, prompting orders of the police or the authorities to arrest all of those with more than one copy at the border.
Oh, for God's sake.
Extra copies were confiscated. So if you're on the border, you'd like go over and buy like, you know, 100 copies and come back and sell them at a marked up price because everyone had wanted news. And then if you tried to get back, the cops would be like, no, you get one paper, plus.
One paper only. Ah, the 90s. We're smuggling cheap cigarettes and newspapers for a thing.
So copies of other newspapers, including the New York Times, were turned back at the border or not accepted by distributors in Ontario. A retired police officer who defied the publication ban by distributing details from all foreign media was convicted of 2 counts of contempt of court.
Jesus.
I know. So Bernardo was tried for the murders of French and Mahaffey in 1995, and his trial included detailed testimony from Holmaker and videotapes of the rapes. Mm. But as I said, it was the audio, not the visual. Yeah.
Thank God.
He testified that the deaths were accidental, later claiming that Holmaker was the actual killer. On September 1st,
I accidentally put a noose around her neck and tied it to a dresser.
But based on his testimony, like we said, it was very specific about her wanting to kill them. So on September 1st, he was convicted of a number of offences, including 2 first-degree murders and 2 aggravated sexual assaults, and sentenced to life in prison without parole for at least 25 years. He was designated a dangerous offender, making him unlikely to ever be released.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Holmaker's plea bargain was criticised by many Canadians since Bernardo's first defence lawyer, Ken Murray, had withheld the videotapes exposing her culpability for 17 months.
That's another thing too, is like because they've offered her a plea bargain, they don't want to show the tapes because it shows how much involvement she actually has, even if there's no audio of her doing it. And they sort of play her up. Well, they make her play up as a sort of, she was the slave and the person that had to do it, he said, for fear of her own life, blah, 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 to make her seem more of a victim, to make the plea bargain a bit more acceptable.
Oh, there was audio. There was audio of her doing all the things. They just wouldn't show the visual of it.
Which would go against the fact, or people would be in an uproar of how do you give her a bargain for that? Yeah.
So then the videotapes were considered crucial evidence and prosecutors said that they would never have agreed to plea bargain with her if they had seen them before and if the guy had not hid them for as long as he did.
Yeah,
He was later acquitted, the lawyer who hid them, of obstruction of justice, but faced a disciplinary hearing by the Law Society of Upper Canada.
And that's a crime again in itself.
Exactly. So there's a whole bunch of stuff about once he went into to jail, he was kept in segregation because there was a lot of hate towards him from the prisoners. He was still attacked and harassed.
Why? I don't understand.
Punched in the face, you know, harassed in the shower. And in 1999...
You know what harassed in the shower means?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So in 1999, five convicts tried to storm his area because he was in a segregation area, and it ended in a riot squad being used to subdue them. Yeah.
Because it was all young girls that he was doing this shit to. And the prisoners, as evil as they are, they don't like it when it involves kiddies.
So there's all this stuff. So there's a whole list, if you go to Wikipedia, about all the potential crimes he should have been convicted for. And if you look at some of the photos, he kind of almost has a baby face, like somebody that you would never suspect is capable of what he's done. So what they believe is that out of all the crimes that he's been convicted for, they're like maybe, you know, 50% of what he's actually done.
And when you look at the Scott and Charlene wedding photo of him, like he does, he looks fresh faced. He looks, there's an evil fucking look and grimace in his face, but she looks like she's been fucking weathered.
So there's a whole bunch of crimes that they're convinced that he's done, but he never owned up to them, and you know, they could never get him to own up to them. He claims to the end that she is equally responsible, if not more so, because she was the killer. He never meant to kill any of them.
But that's a load of shit too. I reckon he's saying it that he didn't, he knew they were going to die. I mean, he dismembered one with a fucking circular saw.
Yeah. And I'm telling you right now, it doesn't matter how traumatized you are when you see, I think the whole sister thing, the fact that what he did to her sister, like whether or not it was an accident, you know, whatever, you don't come back from that.
It to her twice. Yeah.
Then you go and tell your parents, you go, mummy and daddy, please.
Yeah. He went to rape her the first time and then fucking did it the second time and killed him. Well, she died. Yeah.
So in court, Holmaker painted herself as an unwilling and abused pawn in Bernardo's horrific crimes.
Of course.
Holmaker divorced Bernardo during this time, and many jurors were inclined to believe that she was nothing more than a victim. She reached a plea bargain in 1993 and was sentenced to 12 years in prison with eligibility for parole after 3 years of good behavior. Canadian press deemed this choice on behalf of the court a deal with the devil. Carla Holmaker now continues to receive backlash for what many have dubbed the worst plea deal in Canadian history.
Did she go through with the name change? Is she still Carla Teal these days?
Just like Liz. Paul Bernardo was convicted on almost 30 counts of rape eventually and murder and received a life sentence in 1995. In February 2018, his parole was denied.
Oh, that's a shame.
I know. Don't want him back.
Surprised he even had fucking a parole hearing. Yeah.
So Holmaker was released in 2005. So she did do her 12 years, right? So she was 1990. Yeah, she did her 12 years. She was released in 2005 to outrage from the public, much of which has been ongoing since her short sentence was announced.
And that's the thing, like you can't, like when that she served the sentence that was given to her, they can't keep her in there any longer, you know what I mean?
Exactly, but I think you're going to like the next bit. Cool. After her release, she remarried and settled into a small community. A small community in Quebec, which you know how desperately I want to go to Quebec.
You do want to go to Quebec.
Forever.
One of the French-speaking nations of Canada.
Carla Holmaker now has, in some respect, become a victim to this community. Mm. Neighbours began a Facebook page titled Watching Carla Holmaker in an effort to track her whereabouts out of fear and anger of her freedom.
Is it Holmaker or Homalaka?
Holmaker.
H-O-M-O-M-O-K-A-L-A.
You say Holmaker, I say Holmaker.
Hella Malaka.
Fuck you. Homolaka. Yeah, maybe it is Homolaka. Who cares?
Homolka.
I've struggled with this, with her name, the whole segment, as well as his name. I'm like, it's too many syllables.
Yeah, well, hers ends with too many syllables. Hers starts off with homo, then LKA. Yeah, how do you do that? Homolaka.
Yeah. Anyway, so they started the Facebook watching Carla Holmoka, in an effort to track her whereabouts out of fear and anger of her freedom. She has since changed her name to Leanne Teal.
Oh, she still went with Teal.
Yeah.
That's sadistic in its own way. Like, why would you?
Though, please.
Yeah, I know, but still, why would you fucking go with Teal after that was, yeah, that's sadistic.
So then she bounced around for a while and then she changed it to Leanne Bordialis with a new husband. But as of 2014, she's returned to the Canadian province where she spends time evading the press, hanging out with her family of three children and volunteering on her children's field trips.
How is she able to do that shit?
Carla Holmoka now seems far from those torturous days of the Ken and Barbie killers, though one can only hope that is so.
Yes, one can only hope. What a fucking, how did, the fact
wild
she's able to have children,
yeah, totally. Ride.
But it's just the outcome as well, that she's got three kids and she works on field trips with children that she used to abduct and rape.
In any podcast we've ever done in the first episode, that I've struggled more than any other time to articulate myself. I was stumbling over every single word.
Welcome to my universe when it comes.
I'm a bit lightheaded. I don't know what's happening. Maybe it's the weather change.
It's the heat. What was the that word I kept fucking up my words to? I would think it was pop
all
culture.
Of them.
Yeah,
all
true.
Of them.
True that.
It's the Reds, baby. It's the Reds.
I know, and I've got to get through it. I imagine Glee is going to be a fucking...
They loosen your tongue.
Glee is going to be a fucking
treat.
Oh,
my God.
I know. All right. Well, shall I get into mine before we get too pissed?
Please. I'll try to be quiet because I've talked a lot.
Oh, no. I need your intel.
Okay.
So this one, I feel, is going to... I hope blow your mind just as much, just in the outcomes that happened out of it. It fucking blows mine. So this episode, I'm covering the mysterious and tragic. Oh God, here we go.
Here we go. Yes.
Tragic death of Canadian nurse Cindy James. So this is one when we said we were doing Canada as our true crime. I didn't know the Ken and Barbie killers were Canadian. I knew of a couple of them, but this one was one that just sort of popped up in our Unsolved Mysteries post I'd seen. I thought, ooh, I'll look into this. So Cindy James, her death has been shrouded in mystery for decades, with many questions still remaining unanswered.
You'd love an Unsolved Mystery. See, I find no
retribution or...
Yes,
no.
I find it just leaves me hanging and I'm like, no!
Yeah. Well,
give me something.
That's one of our rules when we watch true crime here is Vinny needs to know that it's not. So that's why we don't watch Unsolved Mysteries, because he doesn't like not knowing who the killer is. He wants to be able to figure out, oh, it was the boyfriend. Oh, it was that friend's
son.
Yes,
and he likes a sense of closure. I completely
understand
that.
So her story is actually one of the most perplexing cases in the history of Canadian law enforcement. With her death.
Enforcement.
I carried on the law too long, with her death remaining unsolved to this day. Of course, there are many questions and speculations surrounding the case, which I'm excited to get into. So join us, dear listeners, as we delve into the case and attempt to piece together the events that led to her untimely demise.
Your Glee is too much. Save that for the Glee episode.
Cynthia.
Dollar damn.
Okay, you're right. Yeah. Excitement shouldn't be in them.
Reset. Serious face.
Cynthia Elizabeth Hack James was born on the 18th of January 1944, which I do believe...
Oh, the year you were born.
I believe it's the same year you were born, isn't it, you stupid bitch? Can't believe you beat me to that. I had that typed in there after you said it too. In British Columbia, Canada.
Oh, I love Canada.
She worked as a nurse before moving on to become a nurse practitioner in the Vancouver area, so the other side of the country from where yours occurred. She had a promising career.
I know my geographer, plus.
I don't think you do. You didn't know what was north of America. You said
South
Mexico.
America. And South America.
So, yeah.
I'm also not good with my north, south, east, west. I have to never eat soggy Weet-Bix. And I have to really think about it.
A nurse practitioner. I had to find my notes. She had a promising career and was known to be a competent healthcare professional who was dedicated to her patients. Mm. Cindy was described as a Caucasian woman with shoulder-length blondy brown hair and brown eyes. Mm. She was approximately 175 centimetres, a.k.a. 5 feet 9 inches. I also did conversions.
Quite tall for a lady.
Tall. And weighed around 66 kgs or 145 pounds. So she was quite slender.
Tiny to be that much and then that tall.
I know. She is known for wearing a serious expression, glasses, dressing conservatively, and was often seen wearing her uniform or scrubs. Cindy's life took a dark turn in 1982 when she began receiving harassing phone calls and letters. The harassment quickly escalated, with Cindy reporting break-ins at her homes and car, as well as some physical attacks. The police were involved, and there are reports that Cindy claimed to have recognised the attacker but refused to name them. When thinking why someone would do that, it's like they're either protecting the person or scared of the repercussions if they name the person. But that theory also gets a bit messy, as there also claims later on that she didn't know the assailant. So,
and it was multiple too.
Multiple.
Ooh.
So it's like stalkerish. Despite extensive investigations, it was reported that no evidence was found to support her claims, and many people,
surprising, it was the 80s.
Exactly.
And like, she's just making it up.
Yes, and many people, including the police, began to doubt her stories. The harassment continued, and in 1984, Cindy was found unconscious bound with a nylon stocking around her neck. She was taken to the hospital where she was treated for injuries, where she also claimed to have been abducted and attacked by an unknown assailant. After this incident, Cindy's life became increasingly more erratic, with her claiming to have been attacked and drugged multiple times. So what did they do to her? Popped her into a psychiatric hospital several times, where she would be released only to report further attacks.
Someone was fully fucking with her.
Fully fucking with her. And she got put into a psycho hospital. And
she's
safer
in the psycho hospital.
Well, when she came out, there was further attacks. And it's like the times when women, especially back then, wouldn't have been taken seriously and just slap him into a psychiatric hospital and teach him a lesson to stop bothering
the
80s. Police.
I mean, it wasn't like a fucking... It wasn't the 60s. The dino years. It wasn't the 60s.
But it was still... It was still like where they would have fucking not taken her seriously. You know, police back then as well. Okay, I'm just going to stop. So, finally. Saint-Gervais, she say too much. Finally, on the 25th of May, 1989, after days of being missing, Cindy was found dead in an abandoned house in Richmond, British Columbia. She was lying face down, her hands and feet bound behind her back with a nylon stocking and a black nylon stocking tied tightly around her neck. Her death left the police baffled, and the investigation into her death would only add to the mystery surrounding the case.
Okay. So you said in the intro that there was a chance that she had killed herself. How could you kill yourself if you were bound and face down?
Just wait. It gets even better. So the investigation into her death is one of the most extensive in Canadian history that led to more questions than answers. the police interviewed, and I'm glad you actually remembered that from the intro. Good for you. Good for you. The police interviewed over 700 people and collected over 600 pieces of potential evidence. But one of the most puzzling aspects of the case, however, is that they couldn't find any concrete evidence to support Cindy's claims of being attacked. I think there's a lot of concrete evidence, but anyway, there were no signs of forced entry at her home. There were no fingerprints or DNA found at the scene of the death.
She lived in a mansion where you had a passcode to get in. For fuck's sake. Force your way into any house if you know anything about it. Like, just...
Well, or if you're known to them, you know.
I leave my front door open all the time. You know what I do. Oh,
Sky. We do true crime podcasts. Why do you do that? That's when Shelley, when we went down to Sydney and she told me she leaves the back door unlocked all the time. I'm like, I go away on holiday and I put a fucking saucepan with a glass of water on top of it in front of the door in case anyone walks in. I'm going to hear that.
I don't want to live my life in fear. I know that bad things fear. Happen.
I just that's why I don't live in fear, because I know I'm protected. I'm going to hear all this shit. There was, however, evidence at the scene that suggested that she had been restrained and had struggled with an attacker. The police considered several possible...
You fucking dummies.
I know. So the police considered several possible explanations for Cindy's death, including suicide, accidental death, and murder. However, each of these explanations had significant flaws and could not fully explain the evidence.
Oh, murder couldn't. No way.
Seems to me there was enough evidence to suggest she was fucking murdered. Anyway, the first theory that she may have staged her own attacks and eventual death is actually mind-blowing to me. She had ligature marks on her wrists and ankles, and her hands had been bound behind her freaking fucking back. So there's actually a photo of her... the crime scene
this
on the internet.
This is a horror movie. This is actually a horror movie that plays out like this,
yeah.
Where she asks for help repeatedly and no one helps her, and then she still dies at the end. They're like, yeah, she just killed herself.
It was suicide. It wasn't our fault. That's not our fault. I mean, how could it be our fault? So there's pictures of the crime scene. There's a body, and I didn't use it in the promos because I thought it was probably too graphic, but it's on the internet.
Don't.
I haven't.
I already feel really traumatized.
But you can see it on the internet, and you can see the way her hands and her legs are bound behind her, and she's face down, and they think that she did this herself, but it gets even better. Well, worse. It's the fact that it comes as a potential suicide. Comes up as a potential suicide or self-staging through those facts alone just baffles me. Could you imagine how difficult it would be to inflict those injuries on yourself or, you know, try and bind yourself like that and then strangle yourself when you're bound? How do you die when you're strangled? I don't get it.
Obviously, her family were fucked. Like, seriously, no one, like, advocated for her in any way.
To get more answers.
And then people kept putting her in mental institutions, like...
Yeah. The police.
Oh, that poor woman. Honey, I hope you're in peace right now.
I know. But it should also be noted here, so she didn't die from strangulation. There was a toxicology report that during her autopsy revealed she actually died from an overdose of morphine and other drugs like diazepam and flurazepam, which is another reason they list it as a possible suicide.
Which she gave to herself and then managed to get herself in that position.
Exactly my notes.
Fucking
I've got,
dummies.
That's what I've got, which is another reason they list it as a possible suicide. But I would think it'd be quite difficult to take a lethal amount of relaxant drugs like those and then go ahead and restrain yourself, including tying your own hands behind your back after you strangle yourself, put tie on stocking.
Yeah, totes.
It's mad. Plus, there was no motive or apparent reason why she would have wanted to fake her own murder. She had a successful career as a nurse and had no apparent financial or personal problems that would have led to her wanting to stage her own death. But some investigators and experts still believe that Cindy James's mental illness, the supposed lack of evidence and inconsistencies in her stories, led her to cause harm to herself and fabricate the attacks. I know. Your face is exactly how I feel.
Oh.
Another theory is around the claims that Cindy herself, Another theory is around the claims from Cindy herself that she was the victim of a stalker or even a serial killer.
Fucking clearly.
Some investigators believe that Cindy James was actually was being stalked by someone who had become obsessed with her. This person may have been someone she knew, such as a former lover, a patient, co-worker, or acquaintance, which could explain for the no forced entry.
So hold on. So she died with the stocking around her neck. There was repeated attempts of her being
she was also found
attacked in her house with the stocking around her neck.
Where she was found unconscious and drugged.
And she did it to herself and she ended up in a mental institution. Oh my God.
I know.
Oh,
I know.
Canada.
Why?
Oh, Canada.
So
in we can't talk though. We've got some terrible stories in our past. 100%. Oh, this poor
It was a different time. In the lead up to her death, she reported experiencing over 100 incidents of harassment, stalking, and physical attacks over the course of several years.
If no one listened to her, do you know it's horrible? But she's probably better off dead because the trauma that she would have experienced.
She would have felt like she would have felt like Bronte with Harrison, a complete crazy person.
That's nothing close. Bronte has not experienced what this poor woman did.
Oh, no, but you just make you feel like you actually are crazy.
But also experienced immense levels of trauma throughout all that, where she's actually being like, you know.
Yeah.
And then.
And drugged.
Like, oh, that poor. Honey, so, I hope you're in heaven. I just hope you're at peace.
I know. Well, some of these incidents that she reports included being drugged, receiving threatening phone calls, and having her house broken into. She also reported that she was receiving strange phone calls over the years in the lead up to her death, including some that were recorded and played back to her. The caller's voice was disguised and the contents of the calls were often cryptic and disturbing. She also claimed to have received disturbing letters in the lead up to the attack, some of which contained strange symbols and drawings, again cryptic and containing veiled threats. And I've got them in the promo pictures, so you'll see them there too.
So they exist.
Yeah, yeah, they're real, but they don't know if she did it herself. They thought she was this mastermind about her own, I'm going to get people to fucking think that I murdered myself. In 1988, Cindy disappeared for several hours, as I was saying before, only to be found later by police in a distressed state with her hands tied behind her back again. However, some investigators believe that this abduction may have been staged by Cindy James herself. Remember, she was only found a year later, dead, in the same situation, kidnapped and bound. It is also possible that Cindy James was attacked by a stranger who had no connection to her at all. This person may have been a serial killer or a psychopath who targeted women in the area. There were a couple of serial killers that were active at the time, though none of these have officially been linked to the case.
Can I just say one thing?
Of course.
Maths, talk about gaslighting.
Yeah.
This is the OG gaslighting.
Isn't
it? Bitch is like, seriously, the worst situation where someone's like trying to make her feel crazy.
Completely.
Everyone thinks
fucking
she's crazy, doing all these horrible things to her. This is fuck you dumb maths contestant.
Gaslighters.
Don't ever use that word to me ever again. James was fucking
completely gaslighted. That's gaslighting.
And they never found him. He's never been convicted, right?
Yeah, they don't know what happened.
They still think she killed herself.
Well, it's a possibility. That's what they say. Anyway, so she could have fallen victim to one of those creeps, but I kind of think it actually has to do with her ex-husband, Dr. Roy Makepeace. It's reported she had a tumultuous relationship with him, which ended in divorce in 1982.
He was a doctor. Oh, there you go, mate.
He was an intelligent guy. The couple had been married for 6 years and their relationships had been characterized by domestic violence and harassment, and Cindy had accused Roy of physically assaulting her and stalking her after their divorce.
Oh, okay.
So there were actually several factors that made him a suspect in the case. So as I mentioned earlier, Cindy had accused him of physically assaulting her and stalking her. On the night she disappeared, Roy Makepeace claimed that he was out of town attending a medical conference. However, there was no evidence to substantiate his claim, and some investigators believed he was in the area when Cindy disappeared. Some investigators pointed out that Cindy's murder had some similarities to other cases where ex-partners had been implicated in the death of their former spouses. So this led some to believe that Roy Makepeace may have been responsible for her death. However, the police investigation did not find enough evidence to charge him with any crime related to Cindy's disappearance or death. And despite extensive investigations, once again, no concrete evidence was ever found that could lead to an arrest or conviction in the case. There were no fingerprints, DNA, or other forensic evidence linking anyone to the case, which again, now I'm just like, maybe it was a cop. Maybe a cop was involved.
My level of, you know, I think doctors are like, have to be really smart.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they generally do have to be smart. And have to,
like, work through a lot of university.
They're like the pinnacle of the communities and shit like that, really, aren't they? Yeah.
And you talk to them. Well, in Australia, you talk to them, and they're, like, the smartest people in the room, right?
It takes a lot of work to get there.
They're smart enough to know that you can't tie someone's hands behind their back and put a noose around their, a stocking on their neck. And
whoever killed her probably didn't think that she was going to get done for attempted suicide. You know, they probably just restrained her, fucking did what they did, killed her.
Well, that's murder, though.
Yeah, and then they probably thought, oh, woohoo, jackpot, the police think it's suicide. Free.
Or maybe they also thought that, yeah, they'd just get away with it. You're right.
But speaking of cops, the thing that really bugs me is the police not taking the claim of attacks and stalking serious in the first instance. So I did a bit of a search, and there are different opinions and theories regarding why the police may not have taken the case seriously of the stalking and the attack allegations. I can't
wait for this.
So ready for it? Just to say it again, the complete lack of evidence, which we've covered extensively, and again, I think it is still super sus. So there was apparently inconsistencies in Cindy James's stories. Some police officers, investigators noted that the inconsistencies in her stories made them doubt her credibility and thinking she was fabricating the incidents. She was also drugged during some of these attacks. So,
and let's put her into a mental institution.
Yes. For example, she gave different descriptions of her attacker, and some of the incidents occurred when she was alone and no witnesses were around. I mean, how kooky is that? I mean, doesn't that happen most of the time? Generally, attackers try to make sure no one sees it, right? This, in turn, led to the delays in investigation and failure to take her concerns seriously. Apparently, she had mental health issues, including depression and anxiety. So some police officers believe that her claims of being attacked were a manifestation of her mental health issues rather than actual incidents. So, again, she's not taken seriously because mental health wasn't really taken seriously back then and now to an extent.
Oh, this poor woman.
The other thing that came into it was, at the time, stalking was not yet recognised as a crime, and many police officers didn't have training or experience in dealing with cases of harassment or stalking.
Oh.
As a result, they may have underestimated the seriousness of Cindy James's claims. Hello. So while there are a number of different factors that contributed to the police's skepticism and lack of action, we can all agree that they didn't take her claims of attack seriously.
She did not kill herself.
And it's
no way in the world.
It's one hell of a coincidence that she ended up bound and murdered if the earlier claims were false, which I think we can agree were not. Some people believe that the police may have focused too narrowly on Roy Makepeace as a suspect and failed to consider other possible theories or suspects. This may have limited their ability to find new evidence or leads in the case. But I think, in all my criminology experience, that he did do it. He was a doctor in the 80s. Maybe he was able to get himself out of a sticky situation with corruption, etc.
So what was her official cause of death, though?
The overdose with the morphine and diazepam and another drugs. So she overdosed, but she still took enough lethal drugs to be able to tie herself up
But so what was the cause? So they're saying it's the official cause on her death certificate was suicide based on drug overdose.
Yes.
Are you fucking serious?
So, yeah. Well, that's what I've researched, yeah. But they're saying that she was able to tie herself up after she'd taken a lethal amount of drugs and a shit ton of them too. I don't know how you'd be able to be that strategic and be able to do shit.
Also, you can't tie yourself up.
Your hands behind your back and your legs. So the investigation into Cindy James's case was complex and required a significant amount of time, effort, and resources.
She
and
must have studied Houdini for years, recreating all scenarios. His mind, boxing things that he does. Like, look, watch me get my lock out of my body and unlock myself.
From a tank of water.
She must have been a contortionist, obviously. On drugs.
So, exactly, with a shit ton of morphine.
Mm.
Some people believe that the police may not have had the necessary resources to conduct a thorough investigation, leading to missed opportunities or overlooked evidence. Overall, it's difficult to say definitively whether the police dropped the ball in Cindy James's case. However, it's clear that there were challenges and difficulties in the investigations. The death of Cindy James remains a mystery today, and it's unlikely that we will ever know for certain what happened to her due to the many, many, many unanswered questions. Bless her. It's really a complex and challenging situation with many aspects that still remain elusive and difficult to get any clarity on.
Bitch was murdered.
Did the police drop the ball?
Yes.
Did her ex-husband do it or some other random attacker or obsessed stalker?
I'm not sure about the ex-husband thing, but I think absolutely she was murdered horribly and traumatized for yonks.
The exact circumstances around her death remain unclear. If anything, is a big reminder of the dangers of stalking and the importance of taking threats seriously.
And locking your doors. But also I feel and closure. And locking
your front doors. The case remains open and there is no conclusive evidence linking Roy Pat Makepeace or anyone else to her murder. And apparently law enforcement officials continue to investigate new leads and theories.
On an end note, because we need to close this episode.
Yes, that's done.
I do feel like Medium has given me lots of closure because it's very similar stories and Alison Dubois always fixes them and finds their murderer.
Alison Dubois.
It makes me feel better about the world when I watch that show. If you're ever worried about this true crime that we talk about, just watch some Alison Dubois. Oh, I don't know that you'd like it. It's very my kind of show. It's not your kind of show.
Nikki, my sister-in-law, loves it as well. I remember when it came out, she was obsessed.
It's the best show ever. I love it so much.
I think I remember a post on Facebook from her saying, I found a show that I could really get into.
Oh, Tyler's like all the time, he's like, I love the show. And I'm like, shut up. I don't think it has the continuity that you need. Like this,
I do like the crazy
episodes that happen is amazing, but there's a lot of lulls in between as well. Well, thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this week's truly terrifying true crime tidbits from Canada. We love you, Canada, but we have some concerns.
I'm surprised that you got through all those teas. I tried to trip you up with those.
Oh, did you? Please. This is my dear. This is how I speak. I'm eloquent.
Tune in next week and prepare to have your culture popped as we both discuss the wondrous, magical, and now also scandalous, there's something in my eye, musical phenomenon that was... We'll chat about the scandals, the musics, the characters, the musics, the characters, and live up to our Gleek status. And remember... if you are whining, you are winning. Good night, super bitches.
Good night. I was a bit shocked when he said that. I was like, whining? What are you whining about? Oh, I forget.
Yeah, that stupid bitch. Mm-hmm.
He's a stupid bitch. What a stupid bitch. That stupid bitch.